Here comes the 301st opening of Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Next week, the world will have to carry on without my usual broadcast. I have no fear this will make a material difference in the functioning of the planet. I'll be in Kamloops bearing witness to the prowess of my 10-year-old grandson. He'll be engaged in a game of basketball or soccer. I mix the two as I'm not much of a sports fan, and our presence has been requisitioned. I shall return, God's willing, the following week. Canada's no-call list seems to have some flaws. The millions who registered found their names and numbers procured by offshore telemarketers who are using it as a sucker list. This appears to be the result of an ill-considered rush by government responding inappropriately to a real need. I wouldn't want to think there was a deliberate bureaucratic effort to stimulate the economy by providing another entrepreneurial opportunity. Telemarketers have a real function in our capitalist economy. They move money from the hands of those who know not what to do with it into the pokes of folks who will spread it around. Looked at this way, telemarketers have the same effect as those who advertise shoddy goods via junk mail and other advertising. I see no reason why Uncle Don should sit back allowing others to have this lucrative field to themselves. I have a plan. I'll be compiling a no-contact list of those not wishing to hear from marketers of any stripe. This list will be published on the Internet where it can be downloaded for free by advertisers. It will give the name, telephone number, mailing address, date of birth, social insurance number, mother's maiden name, and whatever other personal information I can glean from any source. This will be of individuals who do not want to be exposed to harassment. I will assemble my creation from public sources, and there will be no need for anyone to register. My website will contain a stern warning that no one is to use this for purposes of contact. So where's the profit in this for me? I'll follow the example of our TELUS phone company. When you acquire a telephone, your name is included in the next directory, unless you pay a fee for not being included. Clever, eh? I'll use the same tactic. Each person in my registry will be contacted prior to its posting. They'll be offered the opportunity to be excluded for a fee. By the way, I have your personal information. Just send me a $5 bill and I'll make sure that you're left off the list. Canada's new budget is out of the bag. We have the general numbers. It's just the effects that are a mystery to all, including economists, especially economists. It's unclear how much of Harper's package will actually boost public confidence and spending, and how much is cover for the conservative goal of ever-decreasing taxes. Those lower taxes are a minefield for future governments. They will have to take the heat for returning revenues to levels that will begin to pay down the accumulated conservative debt load. Some economists, those not enthralled to right-wing propaganda mills, calculate that reduction of a dollar or two a day in income taxes will have little influence in spending. The average citizen is overburdened with debt, and the extra buck will likely be used to reduce what they owe. Those with money to invest may use their tax reductions to buy the government bonds used to finance that reduction. Net effect, zero, except to increase government debt. Even if all borrowed money thrown into the economy is spent and circulates, there's no consensus that it will keep circulating. Fear is the order of the day, and retrenching is the result. What we do know is that our Conservative Party, the one whose core philosophy revolves around small government and balanced budgets, is dropping us into a $68 billion hole in just 24 months. They've been faced with a choice of turning 180 degrees from their beliefs or losing power. In this political game, it's retention of power that trumps all else. Skeptical economists define today's tax reductions as merely postponements. Income sacrificed now will have to be made up at some time in the future, with interest, as debts are paid down. The stimulus of this year will be the drag in some future year. According to Keynes, in whom everyone suddenly believes, that impairment can be constructively applied in an anticipated future when a bubble again threatens to spark irrational exuberance in markets. But the record of administrations is that they ride these bubbles until they burst. Easier it will be if we are still saddled with conservatives to cut back on social programs. What the hell, that would only hurt those at the bottom, and they don't vote anyway. Having a cop in the family only confounds my confusion. I know that she works assiduously at her job, trying to be fair and upholding law and order in the face of bureaucratic obstructions and petty harassments. But forces in Canada are getting an awful rap these days. From the killing, yes, killing, of a Polish immigrant in the Vancouver airport to the recent arrest of three off-duty cops for beating a man in Vancouver for being brown, it appears that police in Canada are out of control. When it came to investigation of the RCMP officers for the airport killing, the force brought out the big guns, doing everything short of accusing the victim of suicide. They went to Poland to seek dirt on him. They accused him of being drunk. They made excuses for zapping him several times, piling on him, and then denying firefighters access to him for first aid. It's not so much their action that's frightening, it's the cover-up. Those three Vancouver-area cops who gratuitously jumped the Fijian in the wee hours are not being punished in any sense of the word. Suspension with full pay or assignment to desk duty are more like rewards. If three civilians jumped a cop in that manner, there'd be a list of charges as long as your arm, and they would be in lockup right now. In Prince George, a cop was found guilty of destroying security tape that could have been important evidence. The result? A criminal case thrown out and a reprimand for the officer. Bullshit. One thing for sure, we need a civilian body with real teeth to investigate alleged police wrongdoing. An independent institution free of political interference with the power to force testimony, examine confidential evidence, and recommend prosecutions. Until we have such, we legitimately fear police forces which seem to act with impunity, not unlike those of a lawless nation. Afghanistan, for instance. Last week's budget emphasized carbon. It's imperative that we reduce our emissions of carbon dioxide. And how will we do this? By shoveling great amounts of money into research on carbon capture and storage, or CCS, and promoting the nuclear industry. That CCS concept is still about as fanciful as the idea of nuclear fusion providing unlimited energy. Promoting the building of more nuclear power plants is not an answer to carbon emissions, as huge amounts of the gases are released in the manufacture of the plants, as well as in the mining and processing of uranium fuel. At its best, nuclear power swaps the immediate problem of carbon emissions for the requirement of sequestration and guarding of nuclear waste, forever. One might suspect that a push for more nuclear reactors is mainly to boost the value of atomic energy of Canada so it can be unloaded onto the private sector. Does this government really care about carbon dioxide pollution? Their concern doesn't extend to carrying on a program that expires next year. That program gave incentives for development of wind and solar power. The idea of reducing carbon emissions through cap-and-trade schemes is becoming counterproductive also. As recession hit, companies reduce their production, they naturally lower their offing of greenhouse gases. Then they can sell credits for their savings to other outfits exceeding their limits. With carbon credits flooding the market, the price drops, allowing companies exceeding their limits to purchase indulgences cheaply, destroying any incentive to clean up their act. And while governments are trying to induce companies to retain employees, they can make more money by selling carbon credits than by manufacturing real products. This is like the incentive given to Alcan to cut production of aluminum and Kitimat because the government will pay for the electricity that was intended to develop industry. We know that lots of CO2 is coming from the tar sands, but where else? We've been told that natural gas is a clean fuel, producing little pollution when burned. Fair enough, but this ignores extraction of this gas. British Columbia's largest spot emitter of carbon dioxide is just south of Fort Nelson. This is not a tar sands plant, but Spectra Energy's massive natural gas producer. It emits about 1.2 million tons of carbon dioxide every year. The gas field that it taps has the usable gas mixed in with about 10% CO2 as it comes from the ground. That's stripped off and blown into the atmosphere through a 100-meter stack. The company is supposedly looking at returning that waste gas to the ground, but the technology is iffy. There are no guarantees that gas stored down under will not soon escape, and it's certain that in geological time it will. Barring massive government subsidies, why should Spectra Energy care? There's another huge industry producing carbon dioxide, not as waste, but as a necessary component of its end product. That's the soft drink industry. Pop the top of a Coke and you're adding to greenhouse gases. Could the world live without the fizz of pop to save the planet? Anyone for a flat Pepsi? The other day I heard a psychologist explain how humans are befuddled by large numbers. There was no survival value for our remote ancestors in dealing with figures above 100. We thought that Canada stopped producing $1,000 bills to deter thieves like Brian Mulroney from accepting large amounts of cash in small envelopes. Maybe it was actually because people just don't understand bills larger than a C-note. Today's news is filled with stories about millions, billions, and trillions of dollars, but they leave us in a fog. We can't wrap our heads around huge numbers. Perhaps this is why some persist in believing that the universe is no more than 6,000 years old, but I digress. Let me assume, for the sake of illustration, that a stack of 100 Canadian bills is a centimeter thick. Such a stack of $100 bills would contain 10,000 bucks. The average wage earner in our country would then see his or her annual income in a stack of hundreds about double the thickness of the Prince George phone book. A new automobile might require the same stack if the buyer were to pay cash. Finance it, and you can add about half again to that. If the average pile of lumber, plumbing, wiring, and shingles composing a house in Prince George sells for about 300 grand, that would be a stack of hundreds 30 centimeters high. So how about $1 million? 1 meter of tightly stacked hundreds. A billion? 1 kilometer, or around the height of the tallest skyscraper in Dubai. And, of course, $1 trillion is a mind-boggling 1,000 kilometers tall. If it were stacked in Prince George and fell southward, the top $200 billion would fall across the Yankee border. And knowing they're entrepreneurs, they'd sell it back to us at a premium. President Obama is throwing as much as $1 trillion into bailing out his economy from the foolishness, neglect, and greed of its own masters of the universe. We cannot understand that amount by visualizing stacks of cash. It is simply beyond our ability to deal with it. Israel has been vindicated. They were accused of bombing a United Nations school in the course of their attack on Gaza last month. It's not true that their mortars killed 41 civilians in that school, and all reports stating such are merely vicious propaganda. The fact is that a mere dozen people seeking refuge in that school building were injured and none killed. The 41 civilians slaughtered by Israeli mortar shells were outside the compound and therefore, of course, fair game for the invaders. They should have been inside where they would only have been injured, so it's their fault that they died. Case closed. Kevin Page, Canada's parliamentary budget officer, occupying a post created by Stephen Harper to provide objective analysis of government finances, has a warning. He says that this new budget contains elements which could lead us into a structural deficit. Jim Flaherty has projected a deficit which, although huge, is cyclical, meaning that it will self-correct when or if our economy recovers. A structural deficit is one that will persist in good times as well as bad. The time bomb in Flaherty's budget is the cut in taxes, cuts intended to be permanent. If taxes on good incomes and profitable corporations are not sufficient to cover expenses over the business cycle, we'll be on a slippery slope. As Canadian individuals have learned to our sorrow, we cannot continually pile on debt beyond our means to pay it off. Now, why would the crew that professes itself to be conservative promote a plan that could cause permanently imbalanced finances? They're supposed to have a core principle that budgets must be balanced and deficits are evil. Perhaps this belief is discarded in pursuit of a greater goal, like the goal of shrinking government services. With permanently insufficient taxes, expenses will have to be cut to achieve stability. Will they cut the military? That's not in the cards. Will they tax obscene amounts of accumulated wealth? No way. The rich support them politically. If $1 billion would be a stack of hundreds a kilometer high, how can we justify allowing that amount to accrue to a single individual? The hidden goal of Flaherty's creation is to emasculate government, forcing it to abandon programs precious to Canadians, like our public health medical system. Remember that the Conservatives believe in privatizing everything that's not necessary for maintaining order and repression of the restless masses. Let them eat cake and allow us to live our privileged lives in gated communities with our private doctors, our private schools, and our private guards. Let the masses outside the gates go to hell in their own way as long as it doesn't interfere with our wealth and privileges. If you want a peek at the future they propose, take a look at the way this small class of wealthy warlords live in Afghanistan and how the masses scratch a living. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. The United States Postal Service is petitioning Congress to reduce mail deliveries from 6 days to five, as they're losing money. Why, at a time when every other enterprise in North America seems to be getting a bailout, is the USPS worried about a minuscule multi-million dollar loss? This is one government enterprise that indisputably provides a vital social service while employing hundreds of thousands of in scarce jobs, many in remote areas where they are the backbone of communities. Here in Canada, we lost our Saturday delivery service many years ago on the same day that our first-class letter rate was jumped from 17 to 30 cents. No one had the gumption to protest in our complacent nation. Customers continue to visit the local scab postal outfit and pay what they're asked, postage, GST, fuel surcharges, and all. We want to create infrastructure. We want to create jobs, good jobs that can provide dependable income as a basis for mortgages and consumer spending. Why are we not putting mortar to bricks, building local post offices? Here in Prince George, with a population of around 70,000, we have one real post office where we used to have two. Up north along the Hart Highway, we have a cubicle in the rear of a hardware store in place of a post office. This area is growing. Why don't we have a post office instead of a cubbyhole staffed by hardware clerks? Why is my mail delivered to a so-called super mailbox by contracted civilians? It seems that every time I catch one sorting the mail, it's someone new. These are not the secure jobs we need to promote stability. Canada Post officials decry the fact that people are not sending letters to each other anymore. Fewer Canadians send Christmas cards since the special rate was repealed. Does it have anything to do with the ever-escalating cost of a stamp, which was just hiked by another 2 cents? Or will it take a week to, or that it takes a week to send a letter across town? Once upon a time, it was the informal creed of our letter carriers that neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds. Those of us in rural areas never see a government carrier, nor will contractors approach those super boxes if snow is not cleared. They will not right a box knocked over by vandals. I'm convinced that the various deliverers of mail to our box take the day off when they please. Some service, and for such a price. I used to collect stamps. In my collection was a postcard addressed to Howard C. Hill, Williamsport, Pennsylvania. In this town of thousands, the card was delivered. It bore a penny stamp. I also had a postcard with cancellations in the morning inviting someone to tea. That afternoon, it was delivered on time. We don't expect service like that anymore, now that we have email and telephones, but our governments, both U.S. and Canadian, can do a lot more to shore up service while providing that economic stimulus they claim to promote. Better to hire thousands more letter carriers and build post offices than to hand money into billions to failing corporations. If you think the conservative skunk has changed its stripe, think again. Harper's stimulus package contained just enough targeted spending to get the liberal threat off his back. If he really wanted to stimulate the economy, he would have rolled back the restrictions of coverage for unemployment insurance that has shrunk eligibility, making the majority of those forced to contribute to the fund ineligible for benefits. He would have pumped money into the bottom where the lower classes spend every dollar. President Obama has termed the flood of 2008 bonuses paid to Wall Street operatives shameful. But spare some pity for those poor masters of the universe who saw their gratuities fall by 44% from last year's. The average payout is now a mere $112,000. New York's Ferrari dealers will be on the breadline soon. Many recipients of this total $18 billion were the same individuals instrumental in creating the credit crisis for which we are all paying dearly. These clowns were recipients of vast remuneration in the past, and I've been vocal in deriding them in good times. Now that we're in economic freefall, the usual excuse that outrageous bonuses are necessary to retain rare talent rings hollow. Some talent. Obama has the presidency, the House, and the Senate. Why hasn't he taken steps to recoup that money gratuitously granted to this rare talent through an excess pay tax? The U.S. government could put it toward undoing the damage they caused. Let those individuals take their scarce skills into the market and see what they will fetch for real work. George Bush probably visualized a fine marble statue of himself in Washington as a memorial to his legacy. He has a monument of sorts, all right, but I don't think he likes it. It rests on a white pedestal in Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's hometown, and is in the form of a 3-meter-high shoe. It honors not Bush Jr., but the journalist who threw his shoes at the former president. The inscription on this monument reads, "This is a gift for the family of Mudassar al-Zadiri, a hero whose act helped Iraqi people feel proud. I would like to shake that man's hand." In 1987, Brian Mulroney was pushing hard for a free trade agreement with the United States. Oh, the benefits it would have for Canada. As Lion Bryan said, "Jobs, jobs, jobs." I said, "Nuts, nuts, nuts." Our parliamentary representative at that time was Frank Oberle, a faithful member of Brian Mulroney's Progressive Conservatives. He was fondly known to locals as Herr Oberle, as he admitted that one of his proudest moments had been when, as a member of Hitler Youth, he presented flowers to the Führer. But I digress. Herr Oberle called a meeting at Vanier Hall in Prince George for an open forum on the proposed agreement. I attended with alacrity. I was naive enough to believe that he was looking for popular guidance. It became apparent immediately that our Member of Parliament was now not appearing to hear our opinions on the matter, but to explain why he would be voting for the agreement. After his pitch, he took questions. I'm proud to tell you that I was the first to the microphone. I asked why, if a free trade arrangement was necessary, it had to be with the United States, a nation that was obviously fading even 20 years ago. Why not with Europe or some rising Asian nations? My regret is that I immediately returned to my seat rather than holding my place at the mic. Frank avoided responding, instead launching into a prepared, irrelevant speech. In my mind, I replay the scene, where I held my spot, patiently listening to his blather and then saying, "Excuse me, but you've not addressed the question." But the moment was lost. 2 decades later, we know that a free trade agreement with the United States entails. They enforce the parts favoring their trade, and we are free to swallow the medicine. Look at the petty harassment and fees extracted at borders now in the name of security. Look at the way we've been taken to the cleaners on softwood lumber. But it seems that the worst is yet to come. Protectionism is rearing its ugly head, and international agreements be damned. The first round has already been fired, with Congress demanding that American infrastructure projects only use American material. We cannot do the same. We couldn't build a doghouse without buying American nails from an American supplier. We have prostrated ourselves economically in the name of providing precarious jobs in American branch plants. Okay, Canada, you've dropped your drawers for a Yankee dollar. Now let's see how you're going to earn it. 2 days ago saw me huddled with my wife in our lonely log cabin in the wilds as I reread a volume of Jack London's stories. Tales of the rigors of the Klondike led me to rise from my recliner and throw another log into our fireplace insert and turn up the thermostat a notch, fearing not the squandering of another precious liter of fuel oil. London's stories of starvation, of superhuman efforts at survival, struck a chord as I contemplated venturing forth into icy blasts to fetch a newspaper that would enrich our souls before feeding our fire. Ah, this venture might not come to pass, as I neglected to plug in the car last night, but I shall persevere even if intervention of the auto club is required. But first was I to leave the warmth of hearth and home, braving the elements with our 2 faithful and stupid dogs on a mission to shovel a path to the garage and woodshed. Before me lay the task of preparing for next week's long trek to the southlands of Kamloops' barren desert. And this venture I must accomplish without sleep and only minor nourishment in Williams Lake's Laughing Loon pub and eatery. No need to harness the dogs for this one, nor to break trail, as we will be following the white man's asphalt path astride our Toyota 4x4 pickup truck. We will feel not the bitter sting of the north wind, as we will be shielded by fine Japanese steel and warmed by a Japanese heater. Nor will we hear the singing of the wind in our wondrous machine soothes us with the content of compact discs. It isn't easy being a northerner, following the footsteps of hardy men who climbed the Chilkoot Pass, fighting their way to Yukon gold. We, too, must fight the queues at Costco for our sustenance and decode arcane instructions of ATMs to tap our wealth within our nation's vaults. But we shall prevail. I got to stop reading that Jack London stuff. Hidden in Harper's new budget are some time bombs. Not only will the bulk of his supposed stimuli be in the form of tax cuts conservatives have long proposed to cut government ability to fund social services, this enemy of crown corporations has slipped in a new one. This is PPP Canada, hidden in Flaherty's 2007 budget, with an allocation of $1.3 billion to promote selling us out. Its goal is to assure that every possible infrastructure project will be a public-private partnership, or P3. These schemes are also known as pilfering the public purse, since they rob the public domain to support the private sector. P3s are useless parasites calculated to feed on Canada's future. When a public asset like a school, bridge, highway, or airport was constructed in the past, a contract was awarded to a company to build it. Ideally, the government borrowed the cost, paying off the debt over the life of the asset. That asset was held and managed by elected governments, but that was before conservative gurus like the like of which allowed and promoted our credit fiasco to come into power. Under a P3 scheme, a private body is given a contract to build and manage a project. It borrows funds on its own credit and maintains the finished product under long-term contract with the government. The difference between the cost of the project and the amount the government pays the owner is pure profit, a profit that should not exist. P3s are great investments for outfits wanting a guaranteed stream of future income with zero risk. For citizens of the future who must pay for this captive profit through taxes, it's a pure drag. This new PPP branch of Harper's government is more theft of the commons for the benefit of the upper class. It also hides public obligations from budget figures, as borrowing is ostensibly done by the contractor, although we're all liable for it through the guaranteed rent that we will pay. When I discuss Canada's social programs, I don't shy away from using the word class. But we're a classless society, aren't we? One where you and I and Conrad Black count the same, sharing the same opportunities and obligations. Bullshit. As I said before, with rare exceptions like Mr. Black, the rich don't go to jail, nor do they get tasered or thrown in the tank when drunk. Canada's society is riddled with privilege for those born into wealth, and few can break into that upper class. In spite of rare, well-publicized cases where poor kids get rich, if you're born of lower-class parents, you can expect to work the rest of your days for a relative pittance. Suck it up. This is a class-riddled society, and, short of revolution, so it will remain. This has been the 301st edition of Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Back in a fortnight.